Our preaching text today, we're back in James. James 5, 7 to 12. Page 1013 in your pew Bible. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. Patience, steadfastness, our theme for today. Title, patience. James kind of uses patience and steadfastness as synonyms. Everyone is patient when they want to be, aren't they? In the intervening months between our engagement and wedding night, I waited very patiently to be united with Debbie Fleming. I hope I can make up a little for earlier. In the covenant of marriage, patience. Sometimes the wait seemed interminable. We dated, we went to church, we sat in class together at Grand Rapids Baptist College. We sat at dinner with her mom and her dad together. But we were rarely alone together. That would have to wait. For that circumstances, I would have to be patient. I would have to be patient. You single men and women out there too, be patient. Trust more in the providence of God than the pool of people that may or may not be out there. Okay, be patient. I could see the fruit, the end, and the benefit of my patience, though. Therefore, I wanted to be patient. I wanted to be patient. I was able to be patient. I talked with my son-in-law, Chris, and daughter, Katie, last night. Boston College was playing Notre Dame on television, and they're sometimes in the congregation out there at Boston College. So I gave them a call. Chris has spent fully 80% of his life in school. I calculated this yesterday. My son-in-law, Chris Jones, has spent fully 80% of his life in school in one way, shape, or form, anticipating gaining his livelihood as a scholar. You have to understand this about Chris. Some of you cannot comprehend this. He has had to be very patient in doing it. He has postponed family, fame, and fortune to achieve it. The benefits of his patience. You need to be patient with Chris Jones as well. I've had to be patient with Chris Jones as well as his father-in-law. The benefits of his patience, I can see, though, there are many for the kingdom of God. Chris is a regenerate, vibrant young Christian in a world of lost but brilliant men. He is a bright-thinking Protestant, too. A bright-thinking Protestant in a field of study dominated by Roman Catholics. He is a patient, thoughtful young scholar, and he is a scholar who will make contributions in the field of theology and ethics that will redound for generations to come. My son-in-law, Chris Jones, has patiently built his career as a Christian scholar. He could see the fruit, the end, and the benefit of his patience. Therefore, he wanted to be patient. He could be patient. He was able to do this in pursuing his calling. But nowhere is the relation between patience and reward more immediately evident than it is in the hunt. In hunting, this is true whether we speak of predators in the animal kingdom or the human kingdom. Now, I was beaten up on hunting a couple of weeks ago, so I want to see if I can redeem myself a little bit. I found no better reflection on patience and the hunt than from Lee Kemp, who is a Botswana wildlife guide in South Africa. So these next few paragraphs are hers. She says, predators have their own unique way of hunting. Stealth, speed, strength, and agility are some of the key proponents of predators' hunting techniques. All predators will need patience, she says. All predators will need patience at some time when hunting. When the terrain is not suitable for a stalk, as in open areas, the predator will wait for prey to get closer before attacking. The time a predator has to wait depends on the time it takes for the prey to move within range. Most predators are known to play the waiting game, although some are not as patient as others. Jackals do not wait for long before moving on to seek other targets. I have observed lions and leopards in various parts of Botswana lying in wait for more than an hour waiting for slow-moving prey. The selected prey may be feeding, moving very slowly from place to place, forcing the predator to wait until within range. Patience is the ultimate hunting method. Patience is the ultimate hunting method. But I have personally observed many failed hunting attempts due to a predator's patience running out, or they're mistiming the range of the prey, or mistiming the charge. Immature animals, mainly lions, can also let their excitement get the better of them. The young ones who have usually been taught during the hunt will become overeager and spoil the hunt by charging too soon. Unquote. That from Lee Kemp, Botswana Life or a wildlife guide in South Africa. So those of you who hunt, how true is this of human predators too, the hunter? You must display the same kind of patience. You know exactly what we're talking about here today. The Apostle James appeals to this universal sense of patience and fortitude today. Only he applies it to the give and take of the Christian life, the investment in it by every Christian, and the stake that we all have in its truth claims. Will we be proved right in the end? Many of the congregants in James. I'm getting a little too familiar with the apostle, am I not? Jim. Yeah, Jim. No. James's audience are wrestling with some of these questions. Will we be proved right in the end? Will all of the glorious promises made to us actually obtain in the end? If yes, then we can patiently endure unto the end. If no, then perhaps our patience will run out, as it does with a predator, or our excitement will get the better of us, and we will become overeager and spoil the hunt by charging too soon. So James has much to say to us, so let's patiently hear what he has to say. Verses 7 and 8, for example, patience. Patience. Before you are overcome by your circumstances, James's audience was feeling they were about to be overcome by their circumstances. We've seen the oppression, the holding back of wages, the stealing of property being put upon by their overlords that these congregants of James have been experiencing, feeling about to be overcome by their circumstances. But before this happens, James is saying, keep in mind that when God says he will reward the fruit of your labors, that he will do it. He will do it. Be patient, therefore, brothers. The little word therefore is crucial here. It connects logically this section with the previous section. In other words, owing to the situation obtaining in the previous section, those in this section must be patient. The previous portion of this chapter spoke of oppression and fraud and injustice, even murder, right? Even murder towards these brothers. James then spoke to these perpetrators in warning. He now speaks to the brothers in comfort. To those oppressing the Christian community, he exhorts urgency to change their ways. To those being oppressed as a Christian community, he exhorts patience as they wait for deliverance. The wicked rich oppressors must act swiftly and immediately to change their ways. The righteous poor and oppressed must wait patiently and maintain their ways. To what point then must they be patient? Not indefinitely, he assures them. He says, until the coming of the Lord. Until the coming of the Lord. Now, as we have established in our introduction, James is not speaking to some far-flung day in the future when he talks of the coming of the Lord. It is not the time of the second coming of Christ when the skies are opened and the Lord returns with the clouds of heaven and the regeneration of all things takes place. What a glorious day that will be, indeed. Rather, the interpretive clues in the text, I've been trying to lay this out for you carefully, the interpretive, and you need to read these when you're talking about the coming of Christ, the parousia. Rather, the interpretive clues point in another direction, and that is the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70 by Titus and his Roman legions. That's what the text from Luke, we read this day from Luke chapter 21, was pointing to as well. Interpretive keys all over the place pointing to this. The coming of the Lord, which is in Greek parousia, has a broad semantic range. And it includes God's coming in judgment, not just to his second coming in his return. Parousia occurs five times in the Greek Septuagint. That is the Greek translation to the Hebrew Bible. Nehemiah 2 and verse 6, for example, where King Artaxerxes says to Nehemiah, how long will you be gone? And when will be your coming? That is your parousia, your return. So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time, Nehemiah responds. Interpretive clues all over the place. The parousia in the New Testament became closely associated with this sense of impending judgment. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near, and then they will see the Son of Man coming, parousia, there again, in a cloud with power and glory. And the sense of impending judgment, and vindication is palpable here too. The coming of the Lord is at hand, James says. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. The clear expectation is that deliverance and vindication for their present circumstances is on the horizon, fully expected in their lifetime. So it is. If our date for the composition of this book is correct, AD 62-63, then plans for the suppression of those pesky Jews in Palestine are already underway. All that is required is that James' congregation wait patiently. The oppressions, the robbery, the grinding poverty to which these Christians were subject, we know this is true. From even extra-biblical sources, even Josephus documents carefully. He notes it's one of the reasons for the joy amongst many residents of Greater Palestine when the Romans finally came. It's one of the ironies as you read. And you need to read Josephus's Wars of the Jews. Josephus himself was a Jew captured during the invasion. He became an apologist for the Romans during the campaign. He documents many of these things. So, as an example of patience then, James employs an illustration that all would understand. The farmer. This Georgos, this man of the soil, is a local too, because the early and late rains that are mentioned here in our text, the early and late rains that you see in your text before you, refers precisely to the manner in which this region of the earth, that is Greater Palestine, that's what we're dealing with here. The very region that we're talking about, Greater Palestine, this is how it is watered. That is by the seasonal spring and fall rains. Without them, nothing grows and the people starve. The rest of the known world water their lands via irrigation and flooding. For example, Mesopotamia, location of Babylon, and then Egypt too. From Deuteronomy 11. Where God promises in regards to these early and late rains. He says, and if you will indeed obey my commandments that I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, He will give the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the later rain, that you may gather in your grain and your wine and your oil. Unquote. From Deuteronomy 11, 13, and 14. I found this so good, such a great description of the background to this text that I wanted to cite it in full. This is from Peter Davids. He says, the small farmer in Palestine worked his land himself. Ideally, the family plot that was his by inheritance. The small farmer plants his carefully saved seed and he hopes for a harvest, living on short rations and suffering hunger during the last weeks. The whole livelihood, indeed life itself of the family, depends on a good harvest. The loss of the farm, semi-starvation, or death could result from a bad year. So, the farmer waits for an expected future event. No one but he could know how precious the grain really is. He must exercise patience no matter how hungry he is, for he waits with a view toward the coming harvest. This patience must last until he receives the early and late rain. This patience must last. Those of you that have ever farmed or dabbled in it, perhaps you know exactly what this passage is talking about, don't you, and the patience that you need as a farmer. By analogy, then, this people must demonstrate this same kind of patience. As they wait, then, for the reward of the fruit of their labors, you must too. Our age, our generation, subsequent generations in this country are known for their impatience. We have a microwave mentality, don't we? We have a spiritual microwave mentality, too. We want it now. James counsels, do good in the face of evil. Rather, be patient. Do good in the face of evil that's being done to you. Proclaim the gospel. Live a life consistent with that gospel while others, whoever they may be, whether they claim to be believers or not, while those others steal land and the crops and wages of those who labor for them. One group profits and prospers at the expense of another group. That happens all the time, doesn't it? Happens to Christians. Perhaps it's happening to you. The temptation is to have our patience run out, or our excitement get the better of us, or as in the predator, become overeager, spoil the hunt by charging too soon. Don't do this, James counsels. It's reminiscent of Paul, too, isn't it? In Romans 12, 19, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And indeed, for James's audience, the Lord is about to do this. Not some far off, distant millennia, but right around the corner. The judge is at the door. We too must be patient, relying upon the vengeance of the Lord. Verses 9 through 11. Patience, then. Before you are overcome by your circumstances, keep in mind that when God says he will vindicate the truth of your cause, he will do it. He will not only give you the fruits of your labor, but he will vindicate your cause. And those were days of vengeance that transpired soon after, as our text from Luke points out. They will be days of vengeance. And indeed, the destruction of Jerusalem was a day of vengeance. If these oppressors in Greater Palestine are professing Christians, then it is imperative that they not grumble one against another. It is imperative that they not grumble. Stenazo is the Greek word used there. Do not grumble. The word employed here is used frequently throughout the Bible. Do not grumble. Looking up to heaven, from Mark chapter 7, when Jesus healed the deaf man, and looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. He sighed. There's that same word, stenazo. From Job, too. This is peppered all through Job and And James is anticipating his later reference to Job here by using this word dude, because it's all over Job. Job was known for his groaning. Today also my complaint is bitter, Job says. My hand is heavy on account of my groaning. Stenazo in the Septuagint. So then, anticipating then his later reference to Job, James uses this word as a characteristic of their behavior towards one another. They're groaning and moaning and complaining against one another. It's great to see John and Jessica here today, but one nice thing about an empty nest is the absence of this kind of groaning. Dad, Rachel is teasing me again. Dad, Katie's wearing my favorite sweater again. Dad, Rachel and Katie are eating my leftovers from Mongolian Grill. Don't mess with John's food. I learned that too early. Yeah. Have you seen the outrage in New York at the lack of power since Hurricane Sandy too? The residents are groaning because of their circumstances. That's the kind of stenazo, the kind of groaning that James is talking about here. You guys are lapsing into that as well. Isn't it ironic how those who strike back in righteous indignation often get caught up, though? This is the nasty tar baby aspect of this, isn't it? Those who strike back in righteousness and in righteous indignation, perhaps, often get caught up in the very judgment that they visit on their oppressor. Watching BC play Notre Dame yesterday, it's a truism in football, too. It's not the player who strikes an opponent who gets penalized, but the one who retaliates. Those of you that watch football, you know, I see that every Sunday, right? How many times our coach insisted when someone punches or dirty tackles or blocks you, don't retaliate. Don't retaliate. Usually the referee sees your retaliation and flags you, right? James warns his people, though you may be justified, you too will be caught up in judgment if you retaliate. Those who strike back in righteous indignation get caught up in the very judgment they visit on their oppressor. Now, Josephus will also note in his wars that the Jews trapped in Jerusalem during the siege were so bitterly divided themselves, one against the other, killing, fighting, slaughtering each other, that the people thought the invasion of the Roman legions a virtual deliverance. They were welcoming the Romans because the Jews were so bitterly fighting, divided against themselves in civil war, internecine war. Whatever causes may have been brought forward for this internecine warfare, whoever was justified in Jerusalem in those days, and whoever was to blame, nevertheless, by the time of the burning and sacking of Jerusalem in AD 70, all had done enough to merit complete destruction. James is warning against this. Those who strike back in righteous indignation will get caught up in the very judgment they visit on their oppressor. This is the direction you are headed, James says. Beware. The judge, that is God himself coming from heaven very soon, is at the door. Do not become swept up in retaliation, lest you correspondingly get caught up in the judgment. It's the very thing that will happen in Jerusalem. Rather, follow the example of another Old Testament saint. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, right? He says this. Don't follow the coming example, but rather follow the steadfastness of Job. Roughly equivalent, steadfast patience. Here, James is invoking the entire experience of Job, too. We know of the immeasurable suffering, do we not, that Job underwent? Yet he never abandoned his integrity, did he? He never abandoned his integrity. That's the one thing about Job. All through his, he may have been groaning and moaning and complaining, especially to his unrighteous friends, but he never lost his integrity. From chapter 27, verses 5 and 6, he says, "Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days." And God would vindicate him, right, at his restoration. From chapter 1, then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped, as after having lost everything. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Profound, really is profound. In all this, then the author says, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. And that was consistent all the way through his experience. Can we say the same thing? All of those that can stand with Job, raise your hand. Yeah, me either. Nope. My hand in pride wants to go up from time to time. Have we always behaved such that it could be said of it, in all of this, Pastor Dave did not sin or charge God with wrong. Can't say that about me, fill in your name. James is warning his people that they are on thin ice. They're walking on a high wire. They're poking a buffalo at Yellowstone. By striking back in recrimination and retaliation towards brothers in the church, those who strike back in righteous indignation, even in the life of the church, get caught up in the very judgment they visit on their oppressor. It's context. It's perfectly applicable to our modern age, too, isn't it? After all, can we say that grumbling in the church was dealt with fully and finally in the first century B.C.? That after James dealt with it, it was all gone? Yeah, no. We know better, don't we? Especially if you are a church officer. Grumbling, backbiting, criticism. I'm not saying that. We just have to deal with it. You know, we have to deal with it all the time. Grumbling, backbiting, criticism, rumor mongering, and bitter resentment are alive and well in the church, large or small church. We see the fruit of this time and time again in church conflict. Regardless of who started it, who is to blame, who is just and righteous and the indignant, the grumbler gets soiled by getting into the pigsty of grumbling himself. Those who strike back in righteous indignation get caught up in the very judgment they visit on the oppressor. So instead, we are urged to consider the end of Job. Consider then the end of Job. The conclusion of Job, if you will. You have seen the purpose of the Lord, right? There was a purpose to Job in his suffering. You have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. You can't see that when you're grumbling. You can't see that when you're complaining and charging God with wrong. And here he alludes to our Old Testament reading from this morning, the conclusion of Job. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before and ate bread with him in his house. They showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. The Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, and he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys. And he had also 7 sons and 3 daughters. So, he is exhorting them, take heart. Take heart, brothers and sisters. God is indeed compassionate, and he is merciful. His audience, and perhaps you as well, you and me, enduring suffering and trial, I know some of you are. Some of us more than others. In days to come, some will suffer more than others. But it will come to us all. It may not be the exact nature of the suffering of James's audience at this day. Withholding wages. Cheating. Robbing of land. Even murder. There would be some action in this church if there was murder going on, I'll tell you. Or even any of the other things below. James' counsel to them and to us is to refrain from this behavior. Counsel peace and patience and steadfastness. All of Job. He's returning to a theme articulated earlier. Perhaps you remember this. If you turn back to James 3 for just a moment. Beginning at verse 13, he says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, then gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness, talk about fruits of your labor, and a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Don't grumble, make peace, rather. Learn the ways of peace and reconciliation, not recrimination and grumbling. There and our harvest is at hand, I submit to you. Do you doubt any of this? Well, he exhorts us in verse 12 then. Finally, patience. Before you are overcome by your circumstances, keep in mind that when God says a thing once as a being of his word, he will do it. He's exhorting them now to be men of their word and not commit to rash oaths either. James concludes this line of thought with the integrity of God's promises. What he promises, that is blessing and vindication for you, judgment for your enemies, he will do. The importance of this is underlined. He says, but above all, okay, that's a good flag for us. But above all, that is of supreme importance, overarching all of what I've just said to you, the exhortation is to them, but by analogy, the oath and swearing is to the one who fulfills all the oaths, that is the Lord God. We don't use oaths as the ancients used to use oaths. The oath called God as witness to the truth and the intentions of the swearer. And implicit in the oath was that God would judge between the two parties. The idea of judging, that's the operative action of this section, isn't it? Judgment. And the oath called God to judge between the two parties. The solemnity of this is underlined in the Old Testament time and time again from Leviticus 19, for example. You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of the Lord your God. I am Yahweh. Throughout the period of the Old Testament, right up to the days of Christ, this process was much abused, the making swearing of oaths. The Pharisees were the chief offenders in this, though others were guilty too. Jesus gives us some insight, doesn't he, on the Sermon on the Mount. He says there, and we have seen time and time again that James has had in the background, he's alluded to, cited directly, the Sermon on the Mount and Leviticus 19, and he does that precisely here. But from Matthew 5, again you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. And from this context, the context that Jesus lays out here for us, in the Sermon on the Mount, you can see the various elaborations and the additions, the layers of oaths, the orders of oaths, by heaven, by the earth, by Jerusalem, by the hairs of your head. Oaths were taken in all these manners. They were added to oaths that virtually made them superfluous and sometimes blasphemous. They were by nature human inventions. It did not serve to undergird a man's word, but rather serve to undercut that man's word at the end of the day. That's what James is getting at here. Don't make oaths, elaborate oaths, especially in the context of your conflict in the church. Because it doesn't serve to undergird your word, but rather undercut it. Therefore, Jesus here and James there counsels, let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. And in our culture, in America, like nowhere else, the idea of a man is as good as word is his bond, these kinds of things, that's where this principle comes from. You may not be aware of it in your culture, but it's a good, strong American tradition, right? A handshake and your word, who needs 10-page contract with lawyerese, right? Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Be a man of your word. Still see my father telling me that. In other words, in your dealings one with another as you work through this conflict, be men of your word. Follow through on your word without the elaborate blasphemous oaths. I swear on my grandmother's bunions that God will destroy you for holding back my wages, right? They might be saying. I swear by Terry Bradshaw's Super Bowl rings that God will judge you for talking behind my back. I double dog swear. Ooh, getting close. Getting close to the triple dog, right? I double dog swear by all of Pastor's empty coffee cups that God will waste you for all the oaths you've sworn against me. Try not to be blasphemous by using real oaths, okay? But especially in the ancient world, these were the kinds of epithets that would fly back and forth under these circumstances. You see why this is entirely in context? Precisely the kinds of epithets that would fly back and forth under these circumstances. James's letter might have provided an opportunity for this behavior even, since he has just been so harsh, right, in his valuation of them earlier. Come, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. The other guys are saying, yeah, go get them, James. Go get them, yeah. When, in fact, just by the exercise of that thought and by using then James's own words to fashion oaths, perhaps, they would be guilty as well. An opponent in the church could easily turn around and manufacture an oath condemning his brother, adding fuel to the fire of the conflict. To this, James counsels, above all, brothers, above all, do not swear. And implicit in this counsel is that God will fulfill his word. God is a being of his word. Of this we know, right? He precisely did do this. He fulfilled it to the letter just a few years hence, AD 70, when Jerusalem was destroyed. We also know that he will do the same for us. If your counsel is to grumble, if your counsel is to take, indeed, vengeance, the vengeance that is rightly God's, and make it yours, be patient. God will judge. The judge is standing at the door, is he not? Let us rather work the counsels of peace. Be men and women of peace. The wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Let us make peace here this day. Let us first come then to that place where we see the promises fulfilled in an anticipation of promises fulfilled too. Let us now come as we participate in the body and the blood of the Lord, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.